Members, the meeting will come to order and we'll, do we have a quorum? We have a quorum. Has anyone thoroughly read those minutes for February 26th?
So.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes of February 26th.
Thank you. Representative Erickson moves the February 26th, 2014 minutes for approval. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carried. Well, very good. I think we have a very, a very good day coming forward. I think we have a lot of good things to talk about in the state of education, the state of Minnesota, and we're honored to have Commissioner Casilius with us today. And Commissioner, if you would care to come forward and. And I know, Commissioner, you've been very busy over the interim, and a lot of the results we're seeing and a lot of the developments, I think, have all been moving in the right direction. A lot of work to do, but things moving in the right direction. So thank you, and welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt and members, for inviting me here today to give you an overview of the work that we've been doing together over the past 3 years. And talk a little bit about some of our early progress. Obviously, so much more still to do, and so I'm looking forward to this legislative session to continue that work forward, as well as working with you throughout the summer on any task forces that we might determine are necessary for the next legislative session as well. So thanks again for having me and my entire team here. As you know, Chair, we have Mr. Chair, that we have a cabinet meeting at 9 o'clock this morning. So what I'm going to do is try to go through some of the overview and key points, and then my staff will take over and address some of the other particulars, school finance, early learning, and some of those things, if that's okay with you.
Very good.
And then I'll be available for questions, of course, anytime, and make sure that all of you have the ability to ask your questions and get the answers that you need about certain things that might come up this legislative session. So I'm going to go ahead and get started, if that's okay.
Yes, please do, Commissioner.
So in 2011, Governor Dayton put out his seven-point plan. I think most of you are very familiar with the seven-point plan and some of the priorities, and we've tried to stay very focused on some of those research practices that work. And then we've also really strengthened our accountability system through the waiver and through our assessment system and through really looking at a lens of data-driven evidence that has gone to teachers so that it's more useful to teachers as they teach, and evidence and data that we've been giving to superintendents and schools around how well students are doing. So the shift has really been around really keying in on the focus strategies that are going to get results for children, and then narrow those disparities among children, as well as look at the data and evidence in the results and getting that earlier and faster to teachers and to families and the public so that they have the necessary means in which to hold schools accountable for performance. So that's really been what we've been trying to do. The key elements of that has been to invest strongly in early learning. And many of you are great supporters of the Early Learning Initiative. We started in 2011 with $4 million, changed that to $6 million, and then last year added $40 million to that. So an overall investment of additional $46 million in our scholarships. That has been a really big effort. We also worked to really strengthen our age 3 to grade 3 literacy framework, which also has been a huge win for us. Our NAEP scores were really moved for fourth graders in literacy. We moved from 22nd in the nation to 10th in the nation. And so we know that we're making progress with our fourth graders in their reading, and we think this literacy push that we started in 2011 and continue to push through now. We also have our first year of teacher evaluation implementation that will happen this fall. Every district will begin their evaluation of teachers. Principals began last year, so every principal being evaluated. So those were some of the really positive things that came out of the 2011 session. And as you know, of 2013, some of the real positives that came out was all the kindergarten additional funding for school districts, looking at additional early learning initiatives, really the implementation of the teacher and principal evaluation systems, and just moving forward in the progress that we made around our school finance and funding reform out of this committee and the very good work that's been done with that to break down some of those equity issues about uniformity across the state. And then also looking at special education and making sure that we fund special education. So that's a broad overview. Let me talk a little bit about the results that we're seeing and some of the early progress. And really take this with the fact that we are seeing a lot of pieces of evidence that show that we're moving in the right direction. Some early results, but we are not satisfied. There is a lot more work still yet to be done. And we are perfecting our systems, perfecting our data systems, and perfecting our implementation systems, and perfecting our support systems to schools as we continue to implement this work moving forward. Because we could implement programs all over the place, but it's really about the implementation and making sure that it's systemic, making sure that it's scaled statewide, and making sure that it touches every kid. So that's really the goal that we're working forward. So about 2 weeks ago now, I released a report to school districts, and this is kind of in that whole data realm of giving visual data to the public, making sure that districts have the right data to look at, and making sure that everyone's paying attention to what their targets are. When we received the No Child Left Behind waiver, we assured the U.S. Department of Education that we as a state could hold ourselves accountable, that we could build meaningful accountability models in Minnesota and support our schools that are struggling the most. It's very, very difficult to implement accountability models that everybody sees as meaningful, that are giving the right kind of data to help teaching and learning happen, and then to be sure that that is actually true in its fidelity across the state. And we've been able to really push forward with that. You'll have two pieces of paper in your two reports that were just done. Most of you follow education pretty closely, so you're familiar with the publication Education Week. In Education Week, about 3 weeks ago, they posed the question, is Minnesota the gold standard for waivers? And then they did a more in-depth report that just came out last Saturday that really highlights a lot of the positives of our waiver and accountability system here in Minnesota. And what's great about this is that we're able then to demonstrate that we actually can create meaningful accountability systems within a state department and collaborative and ensure that we don't need the necessarily always to depend on the federal government to make those accountability measures. So we're demonstrating this through our implementation, our regional centers, our accountability systems, and also through the way that we're reporting out our data to the public. What you see in front of you right now and the overhead is one of the reports that we've issued. We, with our waiver, said that we wanted to close achievement gaps by 50% in Minnesota by 2017. It was a very ambitious goal, and it was also very timely because Minnesota has generally paced very well nationally in the top 10 states in terms of achievement for our kids. But it hasn't been the same for all of our kids, and our Achilles heel really has been our disparities. And we took a sharp focus on this, we changed the conversation, and we really set the expectation that all kids in Minnesota would be able to achieve our very high standards, recognizing that our standards have not changed. My predecessor, Commissioner Segrin, set the Common Core ELA standards and also set the math standards. The ELA standards were implemented in 2010, and the math standards haven't changed since 2007. Mm-hmm. I commend her on that. She also did not join the consortia for assessments nationally. So we create our own assessments to our very high standards, and that has been good work that's been going on for over 10 years now. So when in this report, what you see is those schools that are on track and off track for meeting that 50% goal. We sent this out to all of our school districts so that they could understand where they are with the target of closing those gaps in all eight subgroups, including white, black, Hispanic, American Indian, Asian, special education, low income, and English language learners. And to do that in both mathematics and in reading in all of the tested areas. We also have a graduation goal. We've raised that from 80% to 90%. So they've gotten reports on those as well. Currently, you have 65% of all districts and charter schools that are on track in all subgroups or missing one subgroup in math. 39 are on track in all subgroups in reading. 26 are only missing one subgroup in reading. 75% of districts and charter schools are on track in all subgroups or all but one subgroup in reading. 43% are on track in all subgroups in math, and 32% are only missing one subgroup in math. I think I've got these mixed up in these bubbles here. I apologize for that. 31% of districts and charters are on track in both math and reading. So what we did, and I won't go through each of these charts just for sake of time, but you have them in front of you, is we consolidated for the state, looking at the number of districts on track for one group, off track for another group, and then the number of newly proficient students that would be needed in order for them to reach their goal. Every district has this. So you might have one district, for instance, that has, they're off track for American Indian students, for instance. We have 16 of those. And it might be that they have a 2% gain that they need to make. And that might equate to 10 students or something like that. So they're able to see exactly that this is doable, that they can, if they continue to strategize and look at different practices and work very intentionally for these students, that they can ensure that they will meet their proficiency targets. So when you look at this number, this is, of course, is reading that you see in front of you right here, is that we have just 16 districts in the state, and 21 districts for Asian, and 29 for Black, 34 for Hispanic, 87 for free reduced lunch. So you can see these numbers and you look at those, and as the commissioner, what I say is that's doable. So we have a meeting on March 21st with superintendents to be able to say, how can we help you more aggressively to meet these goals? What more technical assistance can we provide to support you in meeting these goals? And that's the kind of work that has to be done at the practitioner level to be sure that they have the right strategies to move the achievement for kids. What's also interesting, if you look at this chart, is that we have 201 districts off track for white students. So what that says, and I think people tend to not understand the white achievement gap, we have made a more rigorous standard for our new accountability model that compares you not to the students in your school or to the students in your district, but you're compared to the statewide average. So that's a much higher bar to meet. It's a harder standard to meet. And so if you're a district, for instance, that is having about 70% of your students, white students, meeting proficiency, you aren't meeting your target then. Because we expect all kids to grow. We don't want the gap to get smaller because white kids didn't grow or white kids somehow didn't perform at a higher level proficiency. The expectation is that all boats will rise, and white kids will rise too. And so I got a call from a superintendent just last week and said, man, I'm making it for my African American kids, I'm making it for my Hispanic kids, and I'm not making it for my white kids. He just hadn't really thought about that before, because this really is truly about all kids. Even in our accountability model now, when we look at our growth measure, even if you were proficient before, you have a growth score now. And the growth score is that you will achieve your predicted growth, even if you're a high-achieving kid. And if you don't achieve the growth that's predicted, your school will get kind of dinged down. And before, we had an accountability system that missed those high-achieving kids. This accountability system does not miss these high-achieving kids, and you can see that in the Ed Week report they commend us on, that we really are looking at all kids. So these reports have been very helpful to our superintendents. They'll be very helpful as I talk about the world's best workforce and the goals that they set about closing those disparities in the data that they can produce in order to show the legislature and the public that we are holding them accountable. So I'll skip the math, and you can see that on your own. Let's go in and talk about graduation rates. Minnesota has the highest graduation rates it's ever had. And we are so proud of this fact that we are raising graduation. In my announcement, I said, I think this is because of our waiver. I think this is because for the first time ever in accountability, we are counting all kids. Before, your high school got just one score. Now you get a score for all 8 subgroups. So every kid matters and every kid counts. That makes the difference in the world when you're not invisible any longer. So we think that this is a huge, huge piece of work. We anticipate that it will continue to grow. But I am concerned just a bit, and I want to bring this to your attention because I think we will want to discuss this in the policy committee about our graduation requirements and our teacher shortages that we have. So our 2015-16 class has very high standards. We haven't lowered our standards. Matter of fact, part of graduating is graduating with both the courses required through legislative statute and also the credits required that you have to have, 21.5 credits. And you also have to pass all of those classes as well as take now the college and career ready assessment. Our 2014-15 graduating class, the first class responsible for taking physics and taking chemistry, and we have a shortage area in those teacher areas. So I think it will be a policy issue that we'll want to talk about in terms of recruitment and retention of high quality teachers and making sure that we have the best teachers to be able to teach those very high level courses with our new high standards that we'll be requiring of this new graduating class coming forward this coming year seniors. So as you can tell on the next slide, we break that down by subgroup and you see the growth in each subgroup. And this is not new information to you. And we see, again, still continued closure of the achievement gap and progress toward the continued achievement gap. And in your packets, I did put those graduation requirements so that you could see a copy of those graduation requirements and what's required for the upcoming senior class. So the new flexibility waiver strengthens the accountability system by, one, setting the new goal targets to reduce the achievement gap in half by 2017, giving every school an achievement gap measure, which they've never had before, raising the graduation rate goal to 90% instead of 80%, and acknowledging the importance of growth for every single student, providing more and better data to both the public, to parents, and to teachers so that they can use this data in order to help improve student achievement. The waiver also transitioned from what we believed was a punitive system to one that was to more of one that's targeted strategic support to our schools that are struggling the most. We've empowered a statewide system of support that can provide professional development to teachers through regional centers of excellence, and I want to thank this body for giving us an additional $2 million last year in order to expand that even more across the state. We put in 14,000 hours of support and technical assistance to those schools that were struggling the most. And we think that this is the kind of work that's really making a difference. Teachers learn best from other teachers. And so to be able to give them the data tools in order to be able to make sound decisions, to help them implement their standards, we just released a standards implementation kit, which is just phenomenal to help them understand the new Common Core ELA standards and to be able to embed those and to work them in all the disciplines is phenomenal. And again, Minnesota teachers created those standards and adopted them prior to my coming. Created the opportunities to learn from best practices and our high-performing schools. We have a number of reward schools because it's not just a punitive, you're on the failing list, but we look at excellent schools in celebration status and reward status. Maybe some of you have some of these schools. They're very proud of that recognition, and they're happy to share what their work is with other schools that are struggling still. So let me talk a little bit about the flexibility waiver and what we've been able to find with our priority and our focus schools. So priority schools are the 5% of schools that are scoring the lowest on our achievement measures. And then the focus schools are those 10% of schools that contribute the most to the state's achievement gap, and they have the largest achievement gaps in the state. And we wanted to be able to focus and provide the support very targeted with those. And again, it was 14,000 hours that we provided over the past year. So of the 17 priority schools that were removed from the priority status because of their progress, 13 of those schools were our current, were our previous SIG schools, which are the school improvement grant schools. They got additional dollars from the federal government. And those were the schools that really, really struggled. and 7 priority schools received celebration-eligible recognition, and 2 had such good gains that they became reward schools. So we're very, very proud of those schools and the accelerated improvement that they were able to see. 78% of priority schools demonstrated improvement on the multiple measurements rating from 2012 to 2013, 33% of which improved by more than 20 points. On the focus schools, we had 10 focus schools that demonstrated such good progress that they no longer had to have the focus designation. Of course, you needed that for 2 years. 14 focus schools received the celebration eligible recognition, and 1 became a reward school. 71% of them improved their overall MMR rating. So we saw 71% of focus schools improve through the regional center support. We saw 78% of our priority schools improve. And so we really feel that we're able to show that this approach and this strategy of supporting teachers right in their local communities and letting them come up with the solutions, but providing that very technical support to their very specialized student population seems to be working. 99 schools received multiple years of reward recognition. Very difficult to do year to year to have that sustained performance. Reward schools are designated annually. However, some reward schools have demonstrated consistent high performance. 79 schools received reward recognition twice, and 20 received the reward recognition 3 times. So we're learning from these really sustained performance, high-achieving schools. And remember, that's in all areas and all subgroups. So very exciting. So what's been done so far? Through December and January, talking about moving toward the world's best workforce now. So last year we passed an accountability law called the world's best workforce. I think really what we were trying to do is just really build the world's best workforce. But what it's really doing is setting in place a state accountability system where school districts are aligned to what the state is saying its priorities are. And it's really a tight on the goals, loose on the means kind of approach. It's looking at how can we support local control, local autonomy, grow local innovation at the school district level, while still really holding tight on those accountability goals of closing disparities, ensuring kids are ready for kindergarten, ensuring that they're reading on grade level by third grade, ensuring that they graduate high school on time, and ensuring that they are college and career ready. These aren't revolutionary ideas. These aren't things that schools aren't already working on. What is unique is that it's the state that's setting the priorities, setting the direction, setting the outcomes, setting the goals, and saying, school districts, now let's all be aligned in our effort. Let's be aligned in the professional development that we do. Let's be aligned in how we prepare our teachers. Let's be sure that we are holding ourselves accountable to that same standard, and that everybody is understanding and working together toward these common goals within our state, which we know are research-based and will get results. And so we've gone around and done 14 presentations across the state. Every service cooperative, MASA, MREA, all of our key stakeholder groups, 2 breakout sessions at the August Superintendents Conference. We estimate that over 1,000 combined school participants and over 90% of districts have been reached. So all of them are aware. I've covered this in my monthly weekly newsletters and my monthly phone calls to superintendents that I do to ensure everybody's aware and understanding and creating their plans. In October through December of 2013, we've developed a district strategic world best workforce plan. In January, they're implementing these plans. Many of them are their strategic plans, and they're augmenting their own strategic plans to ensure that they're covering all these 5 goals. And developing reports to the to us by October 1, it's required in law that they develop a summary report. We don't need to see the plan. We're not over micromanaging. We want to give them full autonomy. We don't want them to set low goals, so we've been giving them the data around graduation rates in the world and the accountability data that I just gave you, And the public hopefully will hold them accountable to setting very ambitious goals, but realistic goals for the district in addressing what's to be addressed in the world's best workforce plan. And then in fall of 2014, we want to update the district world's best workforce plans with new goals and new strategies. And those will be much more mature plans because they will be the updated plans based on the data and the evidence that they've had and the strategies. And they'll be able to look at how well they're working and work with their public and key stakeholders and teachers on the work that they're doing. So this is really a continuous improvement model that we've put in place for schools so that they understand their data, they understand the standards we've set, they are holding themselves accountable as a community, they're then prioritizing their dollars on those things that work, and they're moving, and if there are things that they need to fix or more aggressively address, then they address those. If after 3 years under the world's best workforce they have not met their goals, this body last year passed that they would then be required to set aside up to 2% of their funding in order to more aggressively meet their goals. I can tell you out in the field, this has been a difficult thing for our school communities. They are somewhat nervous about this, but I just tell them, keep plugging away at your goals. Keep assuming you're on track. Our evidence shows that you are moving toward and making progress. Keep moving progress, because I think what's in the law also is that you're sufficiently moving and making progress. And that's the goal, is around continuous improvement, continuous progress, celebrate the wins, and work on those things that you still yet need to be working on. So I think this is briefly about our regional centers of excellence, so I won't go in depth here. We're very proud of this effort. We think that this is a game changer for us, as well as our waiver and the new world's best workforce accountability model. And we think that these are the things in place that are going to help motivate teachers, give them the right kind of information, and then be able to help direct their work of school districts and school boards in the future in terms of what their priorities are and where the dollars are and what the evidence is that they're actually getting results that we expect as taxpayers and as community members. So what I'm going to do is have the early learning folks come up and talk with you about early learning, unless you have any questions. I have some time for questions, if you would have some questions for me.
Very good. Thank you very much, Commissioner Casalius. And we do have a few questions, if you wouldn't mind. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I had a very sorrowful experience that happened this summer. I was at the Minnesota State Fair in the House of Representatives booth. And this couple came up to me. It was an uncle and an aunt. The man was white, and the woman was Hispanic. And they were very distressed because their niece just graduated from high school. And the reason for their distress is, they said, she can't read. She can't read. Her social worker called her and said, because the grad requirements were dropped, she received her diploma. And they went on to tell me how she had registered at the community college and was going to be taking remedial classes in both reading and math. I found that so disturbing. And could you comment on that, please? As it relates to this increase in graduates in 2013.
Commissioner.
Representative Marquardt and Representative Myra, thank you for that question. We spent a lot of time debating the grad requirements. And I want to just remind folks that it is the school districts who confer diplomas. The local school boards confer diplomas. And it also is the grad requirements that I shared with you. And if you could see them in your packet, they do have to pass all of the course requirements and the credits by our teachers. And we're hoping that, you know, this senior class has had some difficulties with the NCLB law and changes that we've been doing as we've been raising our standards. So I think what I want to talk about in answering that question, Representative Myra, is our future and the high standards that we have as we are working toward a career and college-ready standard rather than an exit standard for high school. I think that seniors who are in those classes haven't had the kinds of supports that we're putting in place now for kids. And I think that they also haven't had these high standards in which teachers are used to delivering those high standards. Let's just take math, for instance. In 2007, we introduced math standards that were very rigorous, college and career aligned, and I commend Commissioner Segrin for implementing those and not moving to the Common Core in the math at that time. And so our teachers are very versed in those standards, and just now we see that our fourth graders are first in the nation in mathematics. And our black eighth graders, our black fourth graders students move from 24th to 4th in mathematics. I bring up that example because I think that the foundation that we're building now, I think that the work that we're doing now in standards and the understanding of the standards, teachers are no longer, at least in mathematics, trying to figure out the content of the standards because they know those and they're well-versed in those. What they are doing now is understanding the student in front of them and the diversity that that student brings. So if it's a language barrier, for instance, or if it is a family circumstance or whatever it is that that child brings or they're behind, the interventions and the type of work that we're now doing with students is much more advanced. We have better data that teachers are getting. Our assessments are better. So they get the information immediately on how well students are doing. And we require, now at the third grade, you helped with that bill actually, that students are getting earlier intervention and parents are getting earlier warning if their students are not reading on grade level. So we think that there's much, there's some good work that's happening there, and we see our reading scores are improving by the nation's report card at fourth grade level. And we think that that will just continue to produce folks, that kids ready for graduation.
Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner and members, I just would like to caution everybody that at least on this handout that we have, at least one student that is a graduate here couldn't read her diploma. And her parents, her guardians, uncle and aunt, were very upset about that. And I am upset about that because literacy is so important. It is the door of opportunity. And we should not be graduating students who cannot read. Very concerned with that.
Representative Seltzer.
Oh,
okay. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for your report. I always am interested in following our progress, and it is to be commended. And I point to great teachers and involve parents and engage students as part of the progress. But now that the expectation, as I would consider it, of accountability has been reduced, repealed, what guarantee do you have that teachers, and I've been one since 1964, and we always had high standards, at least in my classroom, and in my school, too. I know that Princeton sent out some great graduates. Even when the profile came along, we taught to high standards. But not until accountability came along was there really that anxiety that existed among staff, knowing that there was something that we were held accountable to parents, taxpayers, and especially our children. So what guarantees, like when you talk to these superintendents in a few weeks, what guarantees will they give you that our students will still rise to that same expectation we had before we reduced the expectation, the repeal of the last session?
Commissioner Caselius.
Representative Marquardt and Representative Erickson. I do believe that there has been a culture shift. It was interesting when I was speaking at the press conference on graduation rates. I think it was Tim Post who asked me, it's like a light's gone on, he said. You know, and I said, well, you know, it goes back to the accountability that you said. Yes, I've taught for 25 years. I've been an educator. I mean, I didn't teach for 25. I've been an educator for 25 years. And I know that it is very different now about how we look at kids and how we assess kids. And the anxiety you talk about is really the expectation that we're going to hold each other accountable. And I do believe that superintendents have this on the front of their mind. They it's publicly reported in the local papers. They are interested in doing a good job for all kids. So I do think that they are going to be holding themselves accountable. And quite honestly, I shared with you earlier, through the World's Best Workforce legislation, the state has put in place a very strong trigger for them to compel them to want to pay attention to these results. And graduation rate is part of their school accountability system. We've made it harder at the school level in that we report out 10 graduates at the school level. So you had small schools, for instance, before, because it was 40 for the graduation rate before. So a school, if they didn't have 40 kids in their graduating class, or they didn't have 40 kids in one single subgroup in their graduating class, that was not publicly reported. Obviously, it was included in the state report because we report just one graduating senior in the overall state report, but it wasn't reported in the at the school level. And so this has been a game changer for our high schools, and so now they are very much paying attention to their graduation rate. And I put out the Excel sheet to all superintendents with all districts on it, who's at 90%, who's at 80%, who's at 70%, and 60% or below. And if you're 60% below, you're automatically considered, under our new waiver accountability system, a priority school.
Very good. Representative Quam.
I have a follow-up.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Commissioner, has our teacher evaluation, we've had the pilots now, but has our concept of teacher eval been accepted by the Department of Education in D.C. so that now we can move forward and we're going to have all the pieces in place? Has that been accepted by them, our plan?
Commissioner.
Chairman and Representative Erickson, we are still working with them on our Principle 3 of the teacher evaluation. We hope to come back to you in the next couple of weeks with it, that being accepted. But we are still finalizing, and we are still finalizing our renewal process right now.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you had talked about this change in graduation rates. What percent of graduates, it'd be nice to have the additional breakdown of how many graduates each year are greater than 4 years, and that progress. Mm-hmm. And then what percent of students would not have graduated? You know, I'm trying to quantify.
Yeah.
You get rid of the target. So no, and you said schools give the diploma. And apparently there are some situations where some schools might not have exactly the same. And I thought that was the basis for a statewide gauge, so that if you go to this school and you pass all the classes and you don't, you know, aren't prepared, you got the remedial, et cetera, what percent of the graduation that we're going to see is because they no longer are not going to graduate from taking the test?
Commissioner.
Chairman and Representative Quam. Well, in your packet, there's something called data on the graduation rates. Why don't you pull that out and I can share with you what we know before I have to leave here. I have just a few minutes, but I wanted to be sure that you had this information because this question was raised. So because we are moving to our SLEDS data system, and most of you are familiar with the statewide longitudinal education data system, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the statewide longitudinal data system is a system that actually my predecessor also worked to put in place. And we are now, the Office of Higher Education has that responsibility now as of last year in the Higher Ed Committee, and had it funded because we lost the federal funding for that initiative. But we still thought it was very important for our state to have a statewide longitudinal data system in order to generate these reports for accountability and for our public and for our teachers in our schools, so that they know how they're doing. So because we moved to that system just 3 years ago, we now are able to look at data and link assessment data that districts, you know, put in their systems, and we're not on one student information system across the state. Districts have local authority to decide what student information system they want to use. So we don't have, like South Dakota uses just one student data system for all their students. We have multiple systems that speak to our system in the state department, in our data systems. So what you see in front of you here is 2012, when we had the policy, compared to 2013, when we did not have the policy for requiring the reading or the writing. First, I'd like to put it in context that the decision was made to eliminate the grad at the end of May. Most families and most seniors were not following that policy. Folks like Matt Mose or David Heisted were engaged in the policy discussion, so they had a better sense of the policy potentially passing last session, but most others were not confident that this body would pass that new legislative requirements, change the requirements. So, you know, if I had a senior, I'd be ensuring that they actually passed that test, and they were retaking it and retaking it. Plus, these kids took the reading in 10th grade and took the writing in 9th grade, way before we've talked about these tests. And quite honestly, for several years, this body has debated the grad requirements and the exit exams, and there was a report brought forward around using end-of-course exams, and at that time, that was not chosen. And so there's been a number of times that it's been in front of this body that it has not acted on this. So there was not broad-based confidence that this policy would change. So, but it did change at the end of May. And what we see in here is that we can account for 97% of our graduates with our data system. We cannot link from year to year 1,678 records to our assessment system. So, for instance, you might have a student who's Dave in our assessment system or Mohammed in our assessment system, and the school has that record on that student as David or Mohammed. So simply because of a name error or a bubbling error, we're unable to link that child's record to that same child. But the district knows who that child, they know it's David or they know it's Mohammed. And since they confer the diploma, they're the ones who hold the actual record. So there is a discrepancy in records for those 1,678 kids where we don't know if they passed or not because we don't have the pass record. The school district would have that. Now, what's interesting is I pulled the 2012 data, and there are 1,638 records that aren't linked. So there's an overall difference of 40 records between 2012 when we had the data, or when we had the policy, and there are 1,678 records in 2013 missing and unlinked, and we can't link them. So that's the best data we have. We know we can count for 97% of the records and say that they met every single requirement, and we can link it and we can prove it. But for the 1,678 grads out of 54,000 graduates, we can't link that 3.1%, but you can see that it was 3.1% missing when the policy was there, 3.1% missing when the policy wasn't there. So overall, in the statewide averages, we believe that the change was minimal. We think that's because it was so late to coming, and we also think because we're able to link those records, but the school districts have the record, and they know that child, and they know whether they were Dave or David.
Commissioner, how much time do you have left?
I know you're... I probably need to get to the governor's cabinet.
Okay, and I know you're very flexible and very accessible, and I know you'll
be
back here.
So that would come up.
All right. Commissioner, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your questions.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
A follow-up, since the commissioner had to leave, can staff... show us, the commissioner stated we've got the highest graduation rate ever, and we've only got a few years showing in that presentation. Can we get from staff a more comprehensive, going back several decades, the graduation rate, and that way we can have a better understanding because there have been changes in standards, etc.?
Did you,
Chairman,
Commissioner?
Can I address that? I misspoke. Within the decade, we had such different ways to calculate graduation rate in the 70s and in the 80s, and we just don't have that data available. We'd love to be able to say we had it ever. What I meant to say was within the decade. That's where we can actually prove and have evidence of that fact.
And Commissioner,
but there's different ways that we've calculated the graduation rate, and this is the four-year graduation rate that we reported on.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it used to be a five-year at one time, wasn't it? A five-year rate.
We do have a five-year and a six-year rate as well, but this data that we were reporting on was the four-year rate that we've been calculating. And even that had changed in 2010 and 11 to be a much more rigorous kind of way to report the graduation rate. It takes your ninth grade kids that came into the cohort and then how many of them graduated within 4 years. And even that's calculated the same now throughout all of the states so that we can rank states. But what isn't, and I think people forget, is what's not equitable across states are the grad requirements. You know, we'll require Algebra 2, we'll require physics. Other states won't require that. So I just think that people have to understand when those rankings come, the calculation is the same, but the requirements are still very different across states.
So thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Quam.
So I haven't received an answer about the staff providing that data.
I think that even the department could probably provide that. I think what the commissioner just said is that you're going to have not all the data is the same. So all the numbers are not going to be apples to apples. And I think that's the problem we have here. It's been measured different ways. But I'm sure the department can provide whatever data is out there that was used at the time to measure graduation rates. So I'm sure they can. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is maybe partly a comment and maybe a little bit of a challenge to the department and maybe a challenge to us also. But I do think there's legitimacy in trying to understand how the change in policy regarding the MCAs and the cut scores affect graduation rates and going into the future, how we understand the relationship between our other measures of accountability and what's going on there. And I think we need a little bit maybe more sophisticated data analysis, and I know Dr. Heistad has looked at this already a little bit and has some perspective on that. And partly my thinking is, we first of all, to recognize obviously schools are still accountable, and we're shifting to a higher standard in terms of the measure we'll be using with a career and college readiness measure. So to see how our students are performing, and then to connect that to the remediation data, which has been just we haven't been able to move that no matter what we've done in the last 10 years. So there's some pieces there I think we need to look at statistically, but I do think we shouldn't try to dismiss offhand the concerns that have been raised about the effect of the change in policy on the graduation rate and how we can best understand that.
Thank you very much. Very good. Well, we'll move on. And next, thank you. We have Mr. Carter here, Director of Office of Early Learning. Yes. Thank you so much. And please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. My name is Melvin Carter, and I am the Director of the Office of Early Learning, which is an interagency office that's housed at the Minnesota Department of Education, but also includes our state's departments of health and also human services. I'm joined today by two members of our team, Office of Early Learning team, Bobby Burnham, who's the Deputy Director of the Office of Early Learning, as well as Lisa Barnage, who's the Project Manager for Race to the Top and Scholarships. And just as an aside, I've been in this role for still under a year, and have just been amazed by the staff and the team that we are here representing. So the two of them are with me, but we represent a really phenomenal group of public servants who are doing a great job for families across our state. I know it would be definitely preaching to the choir to tell this committee just how critical a child's early childhood experiences are to her long-term academic and life success. The research has very strongly established that, for better or for worse, the early experiences we offer to our youngest children create long-term momentum for children, families, communities, and our entire state. High stress, the impacts of poverty, and what we know as adverse childhood experiences create a very negative momentum and strongly predict negative life outcomes. But by contrast, the investments that you've made in high-quality care and learning opportunities create a very positive momentum on which we can expect to enjoy returns for a really long time. So thank you for your commitment to that. I want to have a conversation about scholarships, and then we'll talk more specifically about the rollout of all-day kindergarten as well, which are two major investments that this body made just last year. The purpose of the early learning scholarships that we've been providing statewide has been to increase access to high-quality early childhood programs for 3 to 5-year-olds and to support the kindergarten readiness of our children across our state with the highest needs. We have been really focused on taking those scholarships and implementing them in a way that really gets to the need through which they were created. Our specific goals are to provide children with high needs with access to high-quality early learning setting of their choice, to build upon lessons learned from previous scholarship pilots that have happened in different places around the state, and also to establish infrastructure for growing and sustaining a comprehensive early learning system in Minnesota. We know that to really do the work that we want to do in early learning over time, it'll require us making sure that we have a diverse, statewide, comprehensive system complete with the infrastructure that we know we'll need to move this work forward. The scholarships are distributed regionally, reaching each of the governor's 13 economic development regions. Our goal is to achieve a fair and balanced distribution based on the same formula behind kindergarten, free and reduced lunch for Metro and Greater Minnesota. It equals just over 4,000 scholarships annually, which is important to note, reaches approximately 9% of the low-income children around our state that could use such resources. That's a map of the 13 economic development regions. I'll share with you that the formula that we ran based on those free and reduced lunches came back just about 50-50 in terms of the scholarships that are going to the Twin Cities metro area and also the scholarships that are being applied and administered in Greater Minnesota. The determining factors more specifically were the percentage poverty on kindergarten free and reduced price lunch. These are the determining factors of which counties and districts the scholarships are available in, were the percentage of poverty based on kindergarten free and reduced lunch, the existence of a priority school in that community. These are the 5% lowest performing schools based on a number of measures, but also frequently are the schools that have the highest number of children in poverty across our state. We included the existence of current state-funded early learning scholarships. We've had state-funded scholarships before and wanted to make sure that we maintained some continuity there so that we weren't kicking children off of scholarships as a result of the increased investment, which I think is critical. That was 10 communities and 460 scholarships across our state. And we also included the cities of the first class in our state, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth. Here's a list of the regions where scholarships are available. I won't read all of the counties necessarily, but within each of the governor's 13 economic development regions, there are a number of counties that those are available, and that will be increasing as we move forward. Here's our scholarship distribution plan. Eligible children are able to access early learning scholarships through two pathways. Pathway one is awarded directly to eligible children through a regional scholarship administrator based on the provider's parent aware rating. So 3- and 4-star rated providers are eligible to receive a scholarship award of up to $5,000 per year. 1- and 2-star rated providers can receive up to $4,000 per year, and providers with a signed participation agreement may also receive a scholarship of up to $3,000 per year per child. So that's pathway one. Pathway two is early learning scholarships are awarded to children through a 4-star parent aware rated early childhood site. That pathway two has been critical as we talk about building a statewide comprehensive early childhood system. Pathway two is really critical to providing the type of continuity that providers across the state need to really build the infrastructure that they can count on to be able to serve children across our state. Our contact for scholarships in the Office of Early Learning is Lisa Barnage, who I said is here with me, who's our project manager for Race to the Top and scholarships. And so that's our specific, the kind of overview of how we're rolling out scholarships. Want to move into full day kindergarten?
Mr. Carter, if you would, just a couple questions here.
Sure.
When you mentioned about 4,057 scholarships awarded, what is the distribution between rural Minnesota and the metro area? on those scholarships?
It's approximately 50-50, and that's based on that formula that I told you about, where we ran the free and reduced lunch. That formula came back approximately 50-50 metro area versus greater Minnesota.
And then also Pathway 1 and Pathway 2, what would do you have the distribution of which scholarships were awarded through each one of those pathways?
Through the percentage, you mean?
Yes, roughly, between Pathway 1 and Pathway 2.
Yeah, that's approximately 50-50 as well.
And just do you see, looking into the future, with this, any legislative fixes that would be necessary or anything that you've run into in awarding these grants that you would think needs improvement?
There are certainly a set of challenges that we've been troubleshooting. I think whether those challenges rise to the need of legislative fix is a subject of conversation, obviously, in this body this year. The things that we've been really focused on is making sure that the application process is working to simplify the application process so that we can make sure that scholarships are accessible and available to folks as accessible as possible. We've been working with our regional administrators across the state to do that. There's certainly been conversation around the cap that was placed on the scholarship. I think that's a strategic conversation mm-hmm. about kind of what we expect the role of the scholarships to be. Looking forward to seeing this body's leadership where that's concerned. I think we certainly, in terms of working with our parent aware folks, we are working to make sure that we have a great representation of family child care in the parent aware ratings. And also we're working to build a better data tracking system so that we can know really in real time. Again, our scholarships are being administered regionally across the state, and we want to be able to track in real time exactly how and where they're being applied.
Very good. So, well, thank you. I know some of the questions last year on this was the geographical distribution, how that was going to work out. So I'm very pleased to see the 50-50 and, the efforts that you're making there. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I mean, yeah. and it's obviously critical for us to follow the data and put the investments where the data shows. And that actually, conveniently, was what the data drove us to.
Well, we do have a few more questions on this area before you move on to the next. So, Representative Hertas, you were, or was that earlier that you were on the list? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there was discussion here about a formula by county for percent of free and reduced. And I was wondering if there was any look to the delta with the demographics so that the actual income in the county, there's data on that. So the delta between sign up for free and reduced and the actual poverty, because in certain parts of the state there's still a stigma to signing up for free and reduced, or some change there, so that if you've got students coming into, this is scholarships for young students, that we really should be looking at the poverty level of the county when we're assessing if we're going to provide scholarships to the county. So I'm just curious if the department looked at the actual demographics of the income by county or only referred to the free and reduced lunch. And I'm not sure if there's a phone a friend on that.
Yeah, Mr. Carter.
Yes, Representative Quam, Chair Marquardt, Representative Quam. Yes, we used the same formula that's used for compensatory revenue, which I understand is a measure of concentration of poverty and not just the number of poverty. We used kindergarten because that's just the closest age to the early learning.
Okay, Representative Quam.
So compensatory is figured not on free and reduced, it's figured on the actual demographics of poverty in the county. I thought in past testimony through the years that was not what was used.
Could we take this offline, this question? I mean, I think we're kind of running out of time. It's getting a little technical. So if maybe after which you could meet and find out the method, would that be all right, Representative Quam? Okay. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that you're here today. Assistant Commissioner, is that right? Or
Director of Office of
Okay. Mr. Carter, how is that?
That works.
Okay. I have a question. It's first a little comment and then a two-part question, and it won't be too long. One is, it's really important that as we look at the 50-50 split that we so often use around here, that it really is a reflection of the population, because we do have, I think we're moving towards third greater Minnesota, third suburban, third urban. So it's really important that the metro area, if it is 50% and it's really two-thirds of the state, that it's disproportional. So I just want to make sure that's paid attention to. And then secondly, and this is a two-part question, what's driving the really low award rates in Region 3, and it's also in Region 11, but I'm interested in Region 3 because that's the communities in which I represent, and because I see that you're around 75%, and it looks like a lot of the regions are almost, you know, to the max, but then we're not even at 50%. So what's driving those lower rates, and what's the department doing to ensure that these scholarships gets in the hands of the kids in this region?
Ms. Barnage, did you want to answer that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Barnage, and I'm also with the Department of Education. Representative, just for your first question, I believe, I hope I can answer that. We did not just do a 50-50 split of the early learning scholarships. In the formula that we used, we looked at the free and reduced lunch of kindergartners in each school district, and it actually was about... It was approximately 49.1 and 51.9%, and that's the actual split we did about regions. We put them in regions. So Region 11, which is the metro area, had 50.9%, and they received 50.9% of the scholarship. So it was directly about the populations of every area, mm-hmm. and that's how we did split it up. Mm-hmm. It just happened to be very, very close to 50%. I think it's a scholarship or two when you actually distribute it across the funding streams. Mm-hmm. So we say at this moment that's 50-50, but it was completely based on populations.
Okay.
To the second question about Region 3 specifically, the data that the department has, on the awards is actually from December 31st. I do know that we have more updated data, and we are in constant contact with regional administrators. And we believe that, based on the reports that we're receiving from them, that there are very limited scholarships available in most of the regions. In fact, in the Region 11, we have been told by the regional administrator that there are no more scholarships available. Applications still come in, but there are no awards left to provide at this moment. And in the rural areas, there are limited numbers. For Region 3, I do know, because it is the same regional administrator as Region 11, they are seeking additional applications, but I felt that at least over 50% to 75% were awarded. I can check on that data, but I'm not sure exactly what data you have that you're referring to, so we could definitely work with you to make sure that we can update that information for you and clarify any other data questions you have.
Thank you. That would be very helpful, because my data shows that January 14th, Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington have only given up 419 out of 1,046 that are available.
And that probably...
Ms. Barney.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative. I do know that scholarships were made available in late October for applications. Because of processing and things, most of the scholarships were awarded in December and in January. So the data, actually even the last data we collected from regional administrators, we've had one say, if you just waited one more week, we would have several hundred more to tell you about. So they are working really hard in each area to make sure the awards are being awarded as quickly as possible.
Thank you.
Anything else, Representative Bernardi?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Barney, just to clarify, did that extra scholarship go to Greater Minnesota, or did it go to the Twin Cities? Because we may have a legislative fix for that if it went to the wrong direction.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Barney. Mr. Chair, I withdraw the question. I want to put you on it. No, just a quick point. One of the things that we're talking about this session regarding the scholarships is a little bit of a frustration level of implementation of it. I know it's going to be a good conversation. Representative Winkler has a bill that hopefully we're going to be discussing. But one of the things I just wanted to point out is the original concept here is that really the scholarships would go to families so that they can choose providers, not the opposite, so the providers can choose families. And I know that that's kind of a very overarching strategy. I just encourage you as you continue to work on this and the implementation, that really is the idea and the concept behind it. And very quickly it can turn into exactly the opposite because the people at the table really are the providers and not necessarily the families. So I know that both of you do a great job in what you're doing. Thank you for being here and testifying. But that's my only caution. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to respond, Mr. Carter?
Please, Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate the concern, and I share that concern. I know one of our concerns in specific with regards to Greater Minnesota, I've got a chance to put in a number of miles around the state so far over the past 8 months I've been in this role. And one of the concerns in many of the places around the state that I go to, particularly in Greater Minnesota, is around capacity issues. And I have folks who I'm meeting with who are saying, you can give as many scholarships as you want in some of these small towns in Greater Minnesota, but it won't matter unless we really have the capacity for children to be able to access those. I was talking to a woman recently who was telling me that everybody in their town, they drive 20 to 30 minutes away to drop their child off at care and 20, 30 minutes back to go to work every day or to come home every day to be able to just access care. And so building the capacity we need, building the infrastructure that we need, actually does require some amount of ability for providers to have some continuity with the scholarship so they can know what to expect, so that they can invest in their spaces, so that they can hire teachers and do some of those things. And so we think that the two pathways working well together provides both the ability for families to access scholarships individually and choose, and also our ability as a state to invest in the infrastructure building that we need to build the system that we know that we need to moving forward.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Nice to see you again, Mr. Carter.
Likewise.
And we've had some very good news recently showing that I think about 3/4 of our pre-kindergartners are ready for kindergarten. That's up from, I think, less than 50%. So that's really good news. And it's exciting that we have over 4,000 scholarships that we're working on distributing. It's a little alarming when we note that we're reaching approximately 9% of the children in need. I know that, and I believe the Office of Early Learning is working on a scan of available services now, including Head Starts and other services that are out there, so that we know really what percentage of students are being served in total. I'm just wondering, have we started that scan or where we are? Do we have any idea actually of the number of students that are total being served in total through various programs in preschool settings?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I don't have a neat number to give you, but it's an important thing to remember that scholarships are obviously certainly not our only tool that we use within the state to make sure that all of our children can be able to be ready for kindergarten between early childhood family education, between Head Start, between our school-based kindergarten readiness programs. We certainly have a lot of other investments as well. And our goal in the context of system building, which I know I keep saying, is not just to have any one of those corners kind of built out robustly, but really to have all of those things working together smoothly so that we have the diverse set of resources available to meet families' varying needs across our state.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to go next to the full-day kindergarten, and that may be it for today. We may not get to the assessment system or the school finance trends, and we would have folks come back later. We've had some good discussion, so I apologize for that, but we'll continue with Mr. Carter on the full-day kindergarten.
Thank you, sir, and I'll move as fast as I can, I promise. As we are implementing full-day kindergarten, that's been a critical investment for our state to make. This graph that I'm showing you right now shows our historical kindergarten enrollment by schedule and program type. Essentially, that green line that's going up strongly is full-day kindergarten, and the other lines, the blue line is half-day daily, then the red line is full-day alternate programs. It just shows that statewide the trend is really toward preferring all full-day kindergarten. That's really critical. That's really important. Because it means that we are having access to children and being able to provide more hours, more kind of curriculum time, and I believe that's actually directly tied to the good news that we've had recently in terms of our kindergarten readiness across our state. We believe that if these trends hold up, we can expect to be at about 95% full-day kindergarten enrollment through our state by fiscal year 15, which is good news. Moving forward, here's some of the guidance that we've developed numerous documents to assist districts and charter schools as they plan for full-day kindergarten implementation in 2015. Above are some of the topics of guidance that we've prepared to date. More guidance based on evidence or research-based practices will be provided in the months ahead and made available on the MDE kindergarten webpage. Note, we've developed the new kindergarten, all-day kindergarten webpage as a resource for districts and administrators across our state on the state's education department website. And we've also now developed the financial and student reporting systems to accommodate full-day kindergarten implementation in 2015, which is critical for us. Multiple sources of data as we think about early kindergarten entrance assessment. There's a question around the state that we need uniform early kindergarten entrance assessment policies. Multiple sources of data have to be used to make informed decisions to best support the child's learning and success in kindergarten, elementary, early elementary, and beyond. Data sources include not just an assessment, but parent report of child's development, early childhood teacher observations, district kindergarten teacher observation, as well as that assessment. A snapshot using an assessment alone may provide a small bit of information, but we have to consider a child's early childhood education experiences and ask that early childhood teacher to provide input as well. We also have to ask the kindergarten teacher to observe the child in his or her early childhood classroom to get a sense of whether she believes the child is ready based on kindergarten expectations and kindergarten standards. So we're working to collect multiple pieces of evidence to bolster the assessment and also add validity to our scores, which could include writing samples, drawings, even video and audio of the child, etc. It's suggested that developmental assessment be conducted in familiar settings to the child, such as the child's early childhood education program or other familiar place. That's critical, obviously, for the child being able to be relaxed and not feel that test anxiety that can also skew assessment results. It's also important that we focus not just on cognitive functioning and skills, but really considering children's social and emotional development and readiness, as well as their executive functioning or their ability to solve problems, control their own behavior, self-regulate. When we think of children from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, obviously thinking of interpreters, assessments that's translatable, functional tasks that are culturally appropriate, and those types of things become critical there as well. Excuse me. This next slide shows that we are providing criteria guidance for school district staff and the selection of assessment instruments for use in assisting in early kindergarten entrance into kindergarten for select students. We're providing a listing of assessment instruments, of potential assessment instruments they can use, and allowing districts to make a determination of the assessment instruments to use based on their student population and district needs. We know we have a diverse state in every way, geographically, ethnically, culturally diverse. We want to make sure that local districts have the ability to select based from a list that we say, you know, is good, to be able to select what they think meets their needs the most. Just in this past February, or just earlier this month, I'm sorry, we provided an in-depth workshop. Provided an in-depth workshop for district and charter school administrators and staff to assist on board-approved policy development. We had presentations by several experts on all of these subjects: childhood development, cultural and linguistic responsiveness, teaching observation, parent engagement and communication, criteria for local decision making on assessments. That was well attended, and the energy around all-day kindergarten is really high around our state that we're receiving. So this is some list of some of the resources and guidance that we're developing currently to provide for districts. We're building a full-day kindergarten framework to provide an at-a-glance overview of key considerations for districts as they implement full-day kindergarten. We are providing a workshop for business managers already this past fall about full-day kindergarten financial and student reporting, and also best practices for implementation, and having a full-day kindergarten series to focus on that it's more than just providing hours, but really teaching strategies and practices framed within the construct of neuroscience to provide optimal learning environments for all children, which is very critical. And so that's the what I came to share about all-day kindergarten. I can if there's any questions about that.
Thank you very much, Representative Radenovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carter. Mine is just a just sort of a quick. I saw that on the trends for all-day kindergarten, half-day kindergarten, and the enrollment numbers, there was full-day alternative programs, and I'm not familiar with them. Can you just kind of give me an idea of what an alternative program is?
I'll ask Ms. Barnett.
Yes, Carter.
Oh, okay, that's programs that are full day, but not necessarily every day. So full day, 3 days a week,
okay.
Or full day, Tuesday,
okay.
2 days a week.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Mr. Carter, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your work.
The opportunity.
Thank you. I think we have next up special education paper reduction. Deputy Commissioner Montaniel. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. As the chair introduced me, my name is Jesse Montaño. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. This legislation was passed last year in order for the department to really get a clear understanding of what exactly would meet the needs of the teachers, because we were hearing loud and clear that teachers felt very strongly that the amount of paperwork that was involved in the due process and the creation of IEPs and all the steps involved were taking time away from instruction in the classroom. And so the department felt that we really needed to get some feedback and input in order to clearly understand what could be developed and meet their needs. We sought input from two different stakeholder groups. They agreed, or it was pretty much agreed upon, that we really need to focus on three goals. One is what we can call FAPE, free appropriate public education. They felt very strongly that whatever was designed needed to improve educational outcomes for students with disabilities. And teachers felt very strongly that the process needed to increase instructional time. We found that most districts already have forms designed. Most of these forms are designed and used nationally. Many districts pay additional fees to have whatever processor forms they used enhanced. There are about seven vendors across the state. The forms may or may not always be in compliance, so hence some of the feedback that we get when we go monitor and we find that some of the forms are missing or are not in compliance, and then additional work has to be done. In many districts, teachers bear the responsibility for completing these forms, hence time away from instruction in the classrooms. And then we found that because districts don't have the capacity, the vendors house the data that is inputted through the process. Teachers felt, and even administrators felt, at the district level, that the priority is on completing forms at the expense of services to students. In other words, if I, as a teacher, do not complete my forms on time, then I could put the district in jeopardy in terms of, you know, the legal implications. We found that many teachers have a difficult time getting the training on exactly what is involved in the due process procedures. Teachers identified a lot of forms and steps that they would like to eliminate. Many times these were requirements, but that doesn't mean that we can't look at simplifying the process or looking at a process that would make it much more user-friendly, even though some of these steps and processes can't be eliminated. They recommended that maybe a consideration should be upon funding paras, and their job would be to complete some of the steps necessary in the due process and to create assessments and IEP writing teams. They also thought that there was enough new technology out there that would allow transcriptions, and we should take those into consideration. They also felt that in some districts, and not all, it really simplified it when they were able to use testing coordinators to complete the initial and the three-year reassessment and to write evaluation reports. These are some of the differences we found in some districts where they could have pairs or they could have an assessment coordinator. But in many districts, particularly in Greater Minnesota, it fell upon the teacher. Teachers also reported to us that they're required to participate in other district and school meetings. So if you, for example, if you're looking at a designing your Title I application, which also might include services to these students, they were required to attend some of these meetings. So they had dual roles. MDE did have or does have a sample of forms on our web. They're PDF, so you have to download them and print them and write. They're not forms that you can complete on web. Initially, I think it was thought that maybe just turning these into a type of form where teachers could go in and write might be simplified the process. But as we delved deeper and deeper into this, we found out that it's a little more complex than initially thought. We also found out that the U.S. Office of Education Special Ed is developing a results-driven accountability system which will likely change all the due process forms and steps. So we need to be careful that whatever is designed meets the future needs, and in a year or two, then it's obsolete and we have to go back to the drawing board. The department feels very strongly that this is something that really would help teachers and districts to have one consistent model, one process that we know is in compliance. Therefore, it would facilitate the monitoring process. We have identified states that are currently developing electronic forms, due process procedures for special ed, and we are looking at researching the functions and the components. They differ from state to state. We've requested copies of RSPs. We've set up some meetings. We've had some. We're looking at setting up others where we actually talk to their staff people, their program people, their IT people, or if they have a contract with the vendors to just look at what components are in there, what's the software, you know, how have you dealt with these issues. The department feels that we need to explore the possibility of creating an electronic system aligned to the new results-driven accountability system so that's not obsolete and that is aligned with our monitoring system so that simplifies the process. We need to look at the data privacy and the storing of data. We need to look at more of that. Where would the data be stored? Districts don't have the capacity. Would it be at the agency, and what are the implications for the agency? We have found that in some states they store it, in other states they don't. The initial appropriation did not take into consideration sustainability and maintenance costs. So we need to look at what would that be. You don't just create something, walk away, and don't continue to do continuous improvement, and also the maintenance of it. So we need to look at that. Ultimately, I think that what the department is looking at doing is developing a proposal that outlines all the components of the system and the functions and determine the cost of developing the system internally or externally through a contract, and then looking to see what would be needed to sustain and do make continuous improvements. And so the department will continue to work with stakeholder groups that do include teachers, administrators, and so forth, as we look at developing this proposal that outlines all the components. And then that clearly gives us an idea of where there's flexibility, where we want to go with this process. We feel that if we're going to do this, we need to do it right. We need to make sure that it is something that is useful to teachers and that provides them the data, the information, the steps, the processes that will ensure that they can spend more time with their students in the classroom.
Thank you very much. Representative Erickson, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your excellent work. I mean, this is really stellar that we're making these kinds of strides. But I want to call your attention to a couple of things that my teachers talk to me about constantly. And I know this committee knows it full well that, you know, home visits and early intervention is absolutely critical to probably reducing the numbers and even helping our teachers know how to address various situations that come to them, because special education, special needs is overwhelming. It's an area that's grown immensely,
and every child has a different need, and every level is different. So I'm not sure what we can do in that area. I know RTI is something that's well-respected, but home visits as well. The other is really concerning to all of them, and that's what either the federal government or state government is or is not doing in regard to what teachers can do to stop behaviors that are out of control. And a prone restraint, and Representative Dabney, and I know this full well, and Representative Mariani too, the fact that parents can't be held accountable for some of the damages that are being done, and the school districts are carrying that, but even what's worse is the out-of-control behavior. I cite my cooperative in Mille Lacs as an example. The children are out of control, and the teachers and the parents can't touch them and can't restrain them in the ways that should be done and stop the damage that's being done. And I think this is probably true in other areas. I don't think I have a unique situation. But my teachers are tearing out their hair, and so are my paras. And, you know, if you could give us some direction, because you've done great, great work in trying to help our teachers with their paperwork, and we're moving so well in that direction. But this other is interfering with their learning and even having preparation for the day. So, you know, I say to this to all of you with passion, because I think it's just still a concern. And I know with our prone restraint legislation, we've not made any progress. In fact, we're going backward, and that's probably the feds. But so that's my statement. Thank you.
Thank you. So I don't know if there's anything we can probably solve today.
We'll continue to be debated.
So very good. Commissioner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're going to have to, I apologize, we'll have to come back at a later date for looking at assessments and the school finance trends. And I, Representative Hertaus, did you have a question? So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. It was as much a comment, I guess, as a question, and it was going to be directed towards Commissioner Caecilius. But in this business of collecting data and the metrics of reporting on it and what we've been talking about today, there's this tendency to create all these groups, subgroups of our students. And I really continue to be troubled with identifying a group of students as free and reduced lunch. Every member of free and reduced lunch belongs to one of those other subgroups. And I don't think that somebody's socioeconomic status or their parents' status has got anything to do with their ability to learn. So that's my comment.
We'll come back to that on another day, but I do want to say a very important point, because I think we heard that the state is moving in the right direction. I think we're seeing all of these kind of data points improving. I think it's important to note that all these efforts came about during the work of Republican majorities and Democratic majorities. It's been bipartisan. You heard the commissioner talk about Commissioner Segrin and things put in place. And I think that's what's really important. And I think also that the taxpayer can feel good because of really this huge push on accountability. And as the commissioner mentioned, we're not just taking general things. We're looking and zeroing in district by district, student by student. And so, you know, every single student is being measured here. And that's what's really going to make the difference. And providing districts with coming up with plans. I mean, what a model, if you're looking for success, doesn't have a plan. And I think that's what we're doing. So I do really commend the governor, the commissioner, and past legislative bodies for setting up this system in place, which I think is really creating some excellent results and rewards, and ultimately will lead to a better economy into the future. So with that, we're way past our time. We will see you. Well, we're meeting Tuesday and 200 here at the State Office Building. That's a joint meeting with Capital Investment. So we're adjourned.